This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tenzina Vega. Now, who's old enough to remember this?
There comes a time when we heed a certain call, when the world must come together as one.
There are people dying, oh, when it's time to lend a hand to life, the greatest gift of all.
We are the world, we are the children, we are the one to make.
Yes, this is the 1984 supergroup USA for Africa singing their mega hit We Are the World. And what is it that brought together superstars Michael Jackson, Kenny Rogers, Tina Turner, Willie Nelson, Lionel Richie, Quincy Jones, and more? Well, a charitable, artistic endeavor to direct American resources and attention to a brutal famine which claimed a million lives and displaced millions more in Ethiopia. For many Americans, largely unfamiliar with the histories, societies, and nations of the African continent, the humanitarian crisis created by the 1980s famine was the first time they'd heard public discussions of Ethiopia. But that means ideas of famine and charity forged lasting impressions of Ethiopia in the modern American consciousness. It's enough to make me want to whip out a 1984 grade school film strip and give all of us a 4 million year Ethiopian history in, let's call it, 40 seconds.
Ethiopia, home to more than 100 million people, seat of the African Union, and a nation whose roots stretch back into ancient times. Dahomey is the earliest known kingdom in this region and was a contemporary of ancient Egypt. This was the home of the legendary Queen of Sheba. She converted to the faith of Solomon of Israel and bore his child, who returned to Ethiopia to rule as king, beginning a long line of Ethiopian kings who claimed direct descent from King Solomon.
Okay, that obviously wasn't the whole history, but you got it, right? Ethiopian history goes way back. It's where humanity began 4 million years ago, where Christianity took root. It's a cradle of civilizations and a beacon of independence on the African continent. And it is a nation currently in the thick of civil war for more than 8 months. Take a listen to this report from Sky News back at the end of 2020.
It was so difficult because we are hungry. We are we don't have any water, any food. We don't have any transportation.
This is the voice of one of the 1.7 million people who have been displaced by the war that destabilized the African continent's second most populous country. Thousands have died, and there are reports of other atrocities, from sexual violence to ethnic cleansing, all primarily perpetrated by the Ethiopian government and its allied forces, including those from Eritrea. Back in November, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, formerly a winner of the Nobel Prize for Peace, launched a sweeping military offensive against the country's northern Tigray region. Now, the attack was in response to alleged efforts to steal weapons from a military base by a political group known as the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. The TPLF was once the most powerful rebel force in Ethiopia, and since taking office in 2018, the prime minister has sought to deprive the TPLF of its power and influence, even declaring it as a, quote, terrorist group. Since November, the conflict has continued to escalate until this week, when the Ethiopian government declared an immediate ceasefire in Tigray as the country awaits election results from June 21st. And while all this violence has been happening, parts of the Tigray are also experiencing the worst global famine since 2011 in Somalia. So how did Tigray become a flashpoint in Ethiopia, and what will all this mean for the region going forward? To answer those questions and more, we're joined now by Samuel Getachew, a freelance journalist based in Ethiopia. Samuel, it's great to have you here.
Likewise, thank you.
And also with us is Cameron Hudson, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council Africa Center. Cameron, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
So, Samuel, you were right in the heart of this just recently. Can you paint us a picture of what it's like on the ground there?
It's really a humbling place. I visited not just the capital, Mekelle, but I was able to go to Aksum and Adigrat and Adi Abi. And the conversation we had was very overwhelming and really, really sad for many of us who've been lucky enough to go there and have a conversation. I think we came back, we began to have a different perspective, not just taking sides. We're not taking sides, obviously, but the impact on the ground does not just change your perspective and your ways, but it also touches on the core of what it means to be an Ethiopian citizen.
Can you say just a bit more about that? Tell me one aspect of what changed in your perspective.
I think the uniform-like sadness of the people, they're telling you the horrors, not just the people that you meet in the villages that are out of touch from, you know, social media or even access to internet or phone lines. But I'm talking about everyday people, the lady who cleans your room, your driver. It's just they're telling you like the same type of story. And, you know, I know there's misgivings about what they're saying because much of it hasn't been verified. But it's just the whole population, the hundreds of people we've met, I've been there 3 times, are exactly saying the same kind of story. I hope someday Ethiopia and the UN would have enough resources to investigate, because we need to investigate and make ourselves be accountable, because Ethiopia cannot move forward unless it looks back and really looks within to move forward, because there are many, many people that have been affected by this conflict.
Cameron, there's currently a ceasefire as of our conversation. Did you see this coming?
Well, I think in the last week, what we saw on the ground in terms of the battlefield situation was the Tigrayans really gaining the upper hand and turning the tide on the ground. They shot down an Ethiopian C-130 plane. They took some strategic ground away from the Ethiopian government. At the same time, we saw the Ethiopian government really increasing its brutality. There was a market that was bombed, over 50 civilians killed. There were some direct attacks by retreating Ethiopian troops on an international NGO, international aid workers on the ground there. So really they upped their tactics, I think, to try to send a message prior to this kind of what I'm calling a tactical retreat right now. So in the last week or so, we did see these battlefield gains by the Tigrayans. Obviously, their retaking of the regional capital, Mekelle, was not a shock, but certainly a measure of their potency and also a measure of the government and their Eritrean allies' weaknesses on the ground right now. What we didn't foresee, however, was this ceasefire. It's obviously something that the international community has been demanding, requesting for many months now, and which the Ethiopians appeared really resolute in not pursuing. But we've seen from the statements that the Ethiopian government released yesterday that they're really trying to spin this retreat really as more of a pursuit of peace and a pursuit of stabilizing the humanitarian situation. So they haven't acknowledged any of the battlefield victories achieved by the TPLF. What they're trying to do is say, we have come to the conclusion that this fight is having too great a cost on the humanitarian situation, and therefore we are withdrawing, we are pulling back, we are instituting this ceasefire in order to achieve the humanitarian gains and the access that we've been trying to achieve all along. So it's a little bit of spin by the Ethiopian government at this point.
So, Samuel, you just heard Cameron talk about this airstrike that killed and injured dozens in this busy market. Now, the Ethiopian army has been claiming that they did not aim to hit civilians, but then you also heard just there this language that it does look like, you know, there may have been this sort of send a message perspective on the part of the Ethiopian military. What have you been hearing on the ground about civilians and their claims around being targeted by the army?
You know, I've been to those villages, and, you know, while the world is becoming aware of the numbers You know, in Africa, we have large numbers, millions of Ethiopians facing famine, for example, or millions of minorities being killed in Rwanda and so on. It's only when you go close and you see the faces behind these numbers that that changes you a lot. But, you know, there has been lots of information given.
Yeah,
given by both sides, and it's really difficult to verify the information. But it's, again, I can't help but feel sorry for them.
Cameron, take us back. I think part of the emotion, the distress that we hear from Samuel there is related to the nature of civil war. Can you help our audience to understand how this began and what this relationship between the Ethiopian military and the rebel forces is in the Tigray region?
Well, it's a long and complicated history between the Tigrayans and the rest of the country. Essentially, the Tigrayans helped to lead Ethiopia's struggle against communist dictatorship and essentially bring about the new Ethiopian state. So they were, you know, liberation heroes of the country. And when that war against the communist dirge ended, the Tigrayans became essentially the backbone of the government of Ethiopia. They, even though they represent roughly 6% of the population, they sort of installed themselves across all government ministries, across the military. They were the sort of lead party and ethnic group driving all decision-making in Ethiopia for more than two decades. And in that time, they both brought prosperity and stability, but at the same time, they ruled with a very heavy hand. And so there were political prisoners, there were, you know, crackdowns on democracy, very poorly run on undemocratic elections, but at the same time, they gained a lot of respect and were given a lot of latitude by the international community because they were such a stabilizing force in the Horn of Africa region. And so, you know, you sort of took the good and the bad with the TPLF, but what it did is it engendered a great deal of resentment among the rest of the Ethiopian population and Ethiopia's other ethnic groups. And so when they were ushered out of power after more than 20 years in 2017 and Abiy Ahmed came into office, he promised a new vision of Ethiopia that tried to look beyond ethnic division in the country and to create a kind of unitary Ethiopian identity and Ethiopian state. This was obviously a direct threat to the Tigrayans who had created an Ethiopian state, a modern Ethiopian state, based upon respect for ethnic differences. Now, of course, they sat on the top of that sort of ethnic pyramid. Mm-hmm. And so they created a system that suited their interests over others. But that's really at the heart of the conflict here, is what kind of country is Ethiopia going to be? Is it going to be one where these ethnic divisions in the country are held up and recognized and respected, and that there are bright lines between these ethnic states? Or is it one where those lines are going to be blurred and we're going to try to create a new unified vision of Ethiopia? That is the heart of the struggle here today.
So Samuel, I want to go to this place where Cameron just took us, that this is a struggle in part over what kind of nation Ethiopia is going to be. And I'm reflecting on, in your first response, you talked about really confronting the suffering of the Ethiopian people, the sadness. Can you talk a bit about this famine that the people of Ethiopia, or particularly of the Tigray region, are experiencing? And is it a manufactured famine?
We visited many parts where farmers are prevented from farming. Animals whose body parts have been chopped, so they won't be able to use them for their farming. As you know, they use the old ways. They don't have any other technology. There are goats and being consumed and many of them really having animals but not being able to farm. I've seen a glimpse. The Tigray region, 1984, even before that famine, that famous famine that made Ethiopia a poster child of aid organizations, has always been suffering from all kinds of stuff, including violence. There's never been a government that has really made Tigray a priority. I'm talking about not as a Tigray. I'm not from Tigray or from the region. So we've seen the suffering. It's the poorest region within Ethiopia, even by Ethiopian standard. Much of the population, as you know, are in need of food aid. 91% of the population, according to the UN, and we've seen them. The people are facing emergency food aid need that I don't think the international community is ready to help. I don't think Ethiopia has the potential to help. But there has to be a real understanding that many people are set to die, and we really have to do our parts.
Cameron, let's go to exactly the point that Samuel made about the rest of the international community. What is the international community currently doing, and what might it be prepared to do next?
One has been, as Samuel mentioned, a humanitarian operation of trying to gain access to the region and trying to avert a famine, essentially, and to provide health and food aid. We know, as Samuel mentioned, that there has been widespread destruction and targeting of civilian infrastructure in the Tigray region. That means hospitals, schools, civilian infrastructure of all kinds, along with food stocks and the ability to produce food. So the international response has been first and foremost about trying to save lives in the near term. But secondarily to that, there's been a very robust diplomatic effort led by, I think, the United States, backed up by the European Union, trying to engage primarily Prime Minister Abiy on his strategy in the Tigray region and trying to get him both to agree to a ceasefire in the near term, but also to think longer term about the political trajectory of the country and his vision for the country. And so that has been less successful. We have seen the Prime Minister resist those calls for a national level dialogue that brings the Tigrayans back under a kind of a big tent and tries to chart a way forward. In the last few months, the government of Ethiopia has declared the Tigrayans a terrorist organization, the leadership, the political party of the Tigray region, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which is leading, the political force that is leading the military effort on the ground, which ruled Ethiopia for many, many years. They have been declared terrorists, and that has now enabled the government to say, well, we can't negotiate with terrorists. There's no political engagement or negotiation that we can undertake with a terrorist group. And so by branding them as such, it really prevents the kind of political dialogue and national reconciliation that the international community has been pushing so hard for. And even in the last day or so, what we have seen from the Prime Minister is, yes, a ceasefire, which we have been asking for, but a ceasefire on his own terms, in his own framing. So a ceasefire because he came to the decision that he wanted to achieve better humanitarian outcomes on the ground, not because he was under pressure or duress from the international community to agree to it.
When Prime Minister Ahmed came into power, there was a sense of, optimism, perhaps. I'm wondering, and yet, Samuel, you also said that there's been no government that has put Tigray at the center, right, has paid enough attention. So right now, how are Ethiopians maybe more broadly thinking about Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed?
The Prime Minister has been the head of government, the Prime Minister, for the last 3 years. He's accomplished much, especially at the beginning, including winning the Nobel Peace Prize in a continent that has only won, I think, 4 or 5 times. He's also engaged Eritrea to try to bring some kind of peaceful coexistence between the two countries. But the last year, many, many things have changed. That's pushing all of us to have second thoughts, even living in Ethiopia, because while... you know, many of us focus on the Tigray region. I'm not trying to discount what's happening in the Tigray region. It's almost every part of the country that's in conflict. It's not worrisome just to me or to someone like me, but it's also foreign investors that have invested in Ethiopia, that have truly changed the face of Ethiopia from, you know, a country with famine to a country having an economy and good enough to feed itself. Now we're going back to the old ways. So it's been a catch-22 in Ethiopia, living in Ethiopia, and the suffering again continues. And that's really, really touching. And again, going back to Tigray, the voices, I mean, you just have to visit them to really understand what's going on.
Samuel, I so appreciate your insistence on the humanity of people. It can be, I think, maybe particularly for the West, that we just presume that the continent is a space of suffering, and instead you're forcing us to remember the humanity of folks who are suffering in this circumstance. Samuel Getachew is a journalist based in Ethiopia, and Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council Africa Center. Thank you to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, everybody. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, set off a firestorm last week when he said this.
On the issue of critical race theory, et cetera, I'll obviously have to get much smarter on whatever the theory is. But I do think it's important, actually, for those of us in uniform to be open-minded and be widely read. And the United States Military Academy is a university. And it is important that we train and we understand. And I want to understand white rage, and I'm white.
Now, the reaction to his comments have been, let's just say, out of proportion, and also more than a little rude.
He's not just a pig, he's stupid.
Like so many other aspects of this recent, somewhat disingenuous debate over critical race theory, the general's comments ended up revealing more about his critics than they exposed about him. On Friday, J.D. Vance, the author and social media firestarter, tweeted, quote, "What I find so enraging about the Joint Chiefs pandering on progressive wokeness is that they know damn well the geography and politics of who dies in American wars. The conservative Americans you trash are disproportionately bleeding for this country," unquote. Now, I'm not sure if Vance knows that African Americans make up 19% of the active duty enlisted, which means black folk are disproportionately fighting and bleeding for the country. But bad statistics aside, General Milley's comments and the criticism that those comments evoked raise important questions about who can lay claim to serving and sacrificing for the nation. And here to explore that with me is Scott Ferris, author of Freedom on Trial, the first post-Civil War battle over civil rights and voter suppression. Great to talk with you again, Scott.
Hello, Melissa. It's always a pleasure.
It feels to me like January 6th revealed some serious problems with former military and police officers being radicalized. Couldn't an exploration being widely read of issues of race help to address that?
Oh, I would agree 100% with that, Melissa. I mean, obviously, we know that groups like the Proud Boys, Patriot Prayer, Oath Keepers, et cetera, have made no secret of the fact that they're encouraging their members to join the military as well as local police forces. I guess they have some sort of fantasy about someday being in a position of authority if they ever have to take over the United States government or something like that. So I think it's a problem that General Milley was certainly wise to raise. I hope it's not very extensive. In fact, we don't have good data to know how extensive neo-Confederate and white supremacist views are in the military, but it's certainly a concern. And the military, being one of the most integrated institutions in American society, you mentioned that 19% of all the active duty are African Americans and 40% are people of color. Obviously, you want to have an organization of that size be harmonious, and so you need people to understand each other, understand their backgrounds, understand their special experiences. And so I think, as you said, General Milley's offering the fairly commonsensical notion that, hey, I should learn about all the people under my commands and understand how they think so that they can all work better together.
Now, J.D. Vance is an author of Hillbilly Elegy and thinks about working class folks. And it does seem to me that there's a working class overrepresentation in the military. Is that right?
Well, I'm sure there's some degree there's some truth to that, in the sense that it's an all-volunteer army, so it is self-selected. And I think a lot of people who have don't have obvious pathways to success in business and other things see the military as a great career or in a way to raise money for college. And so I do believe that people from the working classes probably are disproportionately represented, but I don't think it's on a racial basis. It's more on a class basis.
So, Scott, when you see this sort of question of like who is in the military and what is that military service, that feels to me like it's questioning American identity at its core.
Well, I think it is, though it's interesting. I think on the flip side, too, I think that obviously people of color and other people who've been underrepresented in society, Catholics, for example, once discriminated against pretty widely, have often seen military service as a way to sort of assert their patriotism. And by doing that, hopefully winning equal rights within society. And so I think that you've seen, starting with the Civil War, in which African-American troops were a deciding factor in the Union winning that war, a large number of folks have enlisted in Civil War and the First World War, certainly the Second World War. And again, with the expectation showing that, look, I love America. I'm willing to sacrifice my life for this country and its ideals. And then when I come home, I'd like to see those ideals represented. So yes, it is a sign of patriotism, and it's one that both folks, minority folks, have used to try to advance their equal rights. But I think it's also, as you said, sort of a sense that this is some sort of statement of patriotism ipso facto. If I'm a veteran, I obviously love this country.
Is this attack on so-called critical race theory, which is really kind of a straw man here, but feels like it's an attack on sort of engaging in intellectual, academic, scholarly debates around race, is this consistent with how sort of conservative white discourse has operated over the decades, or is this a departure? Is this something new?
No, this is very much in the American tradition, sadly. I think that one of the things, we've talked about this before, Melissa, I think, you know, that this is all about a struggle for political power. It's a very cynical ploy used by some to divide America by race for their own purposes. And so we see that, for example, in the populist movement of the late 19th century. And it's not a coincidence, I don't think, that the rise of populism coincided with the implementation of Jim Crow. People were very anxious that whites and blacks, poor farmers and others, didn't align themselves in a new political coalition to try to upset the status quo, because those who benefit from the status quo like to maintain it. So we've seen this with that. And then, of course, we also went through McCarthyism, where, you know, people were forbidden to teach Marxism and socialism in schools. And there was, all sorts of distrust. But again, that was not why, just as with critical race theory, it's not widely taught in American universities, let alone kindergartens. Marxism and socialism was not particularly widely taught in American colleges in the 1940s and 50s. But it was a good bugaboo to, again, sort of try to define your party, try to paint the other side as not as American as you are. And so I think you're right. This is a CRT is a straw man. But unfortunately, we set up a lot of straw men in American history.
I'm wondering, though, if it's a miscalculation. I'm thinking about your own writing and the ways that somehow knowing some of the horrors of American race, of white supremacy, actually reconnects me to my experience as an American. It gives me a sense of optimism, of movement forward, and of the possibility of change.
Well, absolutely. And as you know, that's one reason I wrote the book Freedom on Trial, was that I did want to explore my own family's history in a very important part of racial conciliation in American history, Reconstruction. Learned that my great-grandfather was a member of the Ku Klux Klan and was indicted for assaulting some black men to prevent them from voting. And yes, that you know, it did not make me love America less. It made me love it more, because you start to see the struggle that people of color and others have had over the years, women included, to try to achieve their place in society and want to see the Declaration, the Constitution, live up to the ideals that were stated so eloquently 200 plus years ago. So I think a very truthful, honest look at American history doesn't diminish your love of country. If anything, I think it expands it. It certainly did in my case.
Yeah, I would agree. Is there one thing that you would want folks to read other than Freedom on Trial if they were beginning to do some of this work for themselves?
Absolutely. One reason I wrote the book is I hope that it would inspire people. As I mentioned in the book, you know, when we have ancestors that did great deeds, we put their portrait above the mantelpiece and we brag about it. We belong to the, you know, daughters of the American Revolution and the sons of the Confederate veterans and all these things. But, you know, when our ancestors also do something wrong, I think that we need to understand that. And I don't say it means we inherit their guilt, but it does mean that they bequeath us with obligations to help solve the problems that still linger. But I think it's very important for all of us to take a look not only at our American history, but our family history, because often they're one and the same.
Scott Faris is the author of Freedom on Trial, the first post-Civil War battle over civil rights and voter suppression. Thank you for joining me, Scott.
Thank you, Melissa.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. Now, back in the early 90s, if you wanted to get your fix with sketch comedy, Saturday Night Live was not the only game in town. In Living Color, created by Kenan Ivory Wayans, ran for 5 seasons on Fox. And unlike SNL, its cast was predominantly Black, as were many of the show's writers. And while the Wayans family members and cast members, including Jamie Foxx, went on to have very successful careers, the biggest name to emerge from the show was a white comedian, Jim Carrey.
Ooh, somebody stop me!
Now, a group of Black artists paving the way for a white performer's success is hardly uncommon in the entertainment industry. In recent years, this pattern has emerged time and time again on TikTok. Black creators invent a dance, white users perform that dance, and the influencers who get the most followers and money out of these viral crazes typically end up being white. Now, we saw this in March when influencer Addison Rae went on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon to teach the host dances that had mainly been created by Black people. And in response to the backlash over Rae's appearance, Fallon invited the creators of those dances onto his show the following week.
On our last show before break, we did a bit with Addison Rae where she taught me 8 viral TikTok dances. Now, we recognize that the creators of those dances deserve to have their own spotlight. So right now, some of the creators will join me to talk about how their dance went viral and then perform the dance themselves. Up first, we've got Maya Nicole Johnson and Chris Cotter, who created the viral dance to Cardi B's Up.
But after Megan Thee Stallion released her latest single earlier this month, Black creators on TikTok decided to try something different.
I never thought I'd live to see the day that we actually go through with it and see just how much some of y'all need us, especially with making dances that y'all can rip off and say that y'all created it.
That's a TikTok user who goes by the handle Captain Knuckles, explaining why many Black creators decided to go on a strike.
Yeah, for my melanated brothers and sisters of all of the African diaspora, we are on strike. Yeah, we're on strike. We're not making a dance for the... Sorry, we're not making a dance for it. We just gonna let them keep flailing. And it just shows how much y'all need us to steal a dance and to say that it's a new big thing.
So instead of making a new dance to Megan Thee Stallion's song, they want white TikTokers to see what happens when they don't have a dance created by Black people to copy. Here with me now to discuss this strike is Tanja Renee Stidham, entertainment writer for The Root. Thanks so much for being here, Tanja.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
All right, so let's just be honest. I'm old. I'm not a TikTok user, but you are. So talk to me about when you first learned about the strike.
The Eric Lewis, so it's TheEricLouis. I saw his video. It started making the rounds on Twitter, actually, which is very common for TikTok. When it goes viral, it goes over to Twitter. So basically, he uploaded a video with Megan Thee Stallion's song, I'll Be Radio Friendly, hearing you say thought-ish in the background. And he seems to be getting ready to bust out like an 8 count to the song, which is usually right for a TikTok dance, right? Like that song was like very, very, you know, applicable to a TikTok dance. But instead, he chucked his middle finger to the camera and captioned it, "This app will be nothing without Black people." It was so brilliant because white TikTokers simply copied the video without knowing that it was a dupe, right? So it definitely proved that they just copy and paste the Black creators' work without any sense of context, reverence, or respect. And the original content, quote unquote, that came out of that from the Black creator drought is just that the white creators were like flailing about on the camera. So it was hilarious. And we were all making fun of them and proving that their own rhythmic creativity, so to speak, is non-existent.
Let's pause there for a second because I want you to help us understand what's at stake. Now, I don't want to say that maybe my friends and I used to always make fun of the three or four, you know, lovely white kids in college who would come to the Black parties and dance. And we were like, well, they're having a good time. I see them trying there. So, I mean, it's not that I'm unfamiliar with the racial flail in this sense, but talk to me about what's at stake that's different than like what was happening at college parties in the pit versus what's happening on TikTok.
Yes, it's very significant difference because, of course, at first we were having this good time and joking about it and roasting them. But then as it started to evolve, we started seeing that it was pretty much a strike, similar to like a labor issue or the fight for workers' rights. And so the Black creators decided to stop making these dances, to stop creating these dances, because they knew that white TikTokers were appropriating it and stealing their content without crediting them. And they weren't getting any of the benefit for their own creations, which was abysmal. So
the benefit?
Yeah, and that's a good question, because there are some popular TikTokers such as Addison Rae or maybe Charli D'Amelio who have like a bunch of followers, right? They have like in the upper multi-millions of followers. And so, of course, brands and corporations, they want to get in on that with marketing. It's like free marketing for them, for these TikTokers, these popular TikTokers, to maybe promote a brand or promote something. So they get these sponsorships, they get these agency reps and other major deals from this platform. And again, they're doing this without crediting the Black creators. And so when we do call them out on it, they may, you know, throw out a statement here to placate or what have you, or there are like consolation prize, such as like the aforementioned Jimmy Fallon appearance where he invited the Black creators after the fact, after that he platformed Addison Rae with these dances that the Black creators created. There's like this virtual signaling, right, that leads to no real intangible reward for the Black creators who deserve it.
Let me understand this in the context of this longer history. So I'm thinking back to a time when music industry would have actually, you know, Black musicians perform the music, but then would literally put on the cover, right, on the album cover, white musicians in order to cross over, right, in order to sell. And then, you know, maybe you come forward to like an Elvis time where the music, the dance actually comes from Black folks, but who aren't sold or played on kind of, you know, top 40s mainstream radio. And instead, right, Elvis ends up with the credit for things that are created by Black creators. But in the TikTok context, aren't all TikTok accounts equally available to everyone? I mean, in other words, I'm asking, if I'm just sort of a free market person, you know, wouldn't I just say, well, hey, look, people prefer to see the white folks doing it. And that's who they're following.
That's the thing. These white creators have this privilege, right? Because there is this whitewashing, right, of standards of beauty and such things such as that. So they're usually pretty much pushed to the forefront of these things anyway, because of how society pretty much presents them. What's funny about TikTok and what's great about TikTok as a platform and the creation of the platform is that it's unique and that it allowed creators to receive credit. And it kind of limits that, you know, that amount of recirculation theft that happens when you upload a video, recirculate it over and over, because they place a watermark on the video over and over, right? But in this case, we have other creators who are recreating the dance. So they're making their own video and making their own content, but not actually crediting the original creator and saying that this is their dance.
I find it stunning and really smart to put the watermark, right? That's like indicative of understanding how that intellectual property works. Have you heard about other possible ways that Black creators are thinking about protecting what they're creating?
The copywriting thing is the biggest one that I've heard of so far. But other than that, what I do hear is a lot of Black creators trying to sound the alarms to TikTok itself for basically penalizing people, I think would be an ideal situation, who don't credit these original creators, right? Because they made the platform to credit these creators with the watermark, of course. So that was their original intent. So I think they should go forward with that attempt for sure, because though they released a statement, which is pretty much the bare minimum, in my opinion, I'd ideally like to see them penalize this sort of theft.
All right. Talk to me about what an outcome of this strike, you know, might look like. Because for real, I would like to see a Megan Thee Stallion dance. Now, it's
I'm not going to see it till it comes to Twitter, because again, old. But so once it gets over there, I'll be able to see it. But I am wondering, sort of in the context of the strike, sort of how many folks are participating and what do they see as the outcome or the end point that they're going for?
It's an interesting point, right? Because even when, let's say, a TikTok makes a viral video, right? It also benefits the artist, right? So Megan Thee Stallion's numbers have gone up to the stratosphere, basically, because of these viral dances with other songs of hers, such as Savage, which Kiara Wilson made a dance for. But like in this case, they're not doing a dance at all. And so the numbers aren't as good. So of course, because Megan Thee Stallion is a Black woman, of course, I'm rooting for her and her song. And I want her to win. So there's like a, you know, an aspect there and a basically an effect there that happens. But then also, you know, again, I think the priority here is the Black creators, because when we talk about those numbers, the record label is who's, you know, ultimately profiting and benefiting from that.
Now, you spoke with Kiara Wilson last year, right? She's the one that did the Megan Thee Stallion Savage dance. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about that conversation, kind of what stood out to you?
I found her dance and I actually recreated it myself. I think I put it on Instagram or something before I created my own TikTok account, which I have now. Her dance stood out to me because it was so catchy. It was easy to learn. It was so fun. She was so fun. I loved her facial expressions. She actually said this to me, that she always have these very animated facial expressions when she's dancing. But we did have that conversation about the appropriation of TikTok, because it started with the Renegade dance. And so that conversation is within the New York Times. And with Kiara, you know, we were able to continue that conversation. And so she definitely made that point about, while she may not, you know every white TikToker and where they get that from, she definitely noticed the trend that these dances that they create, they blow up into the stratosphere, but without them benefiting from it. Like, maybe you'll get a little sponsorship here or there, but then it's not at the level that these Addison Rays are getting at all.
Is it possible that the white folks just don't realize that this is what they're doing?
I don't think so. Not anymore, because I think even Addison Rae made a comment or a statement notifying everybody that, yes, you should uplift and support these Black creators. But again, I think it's a bit of virtue signaling, because I don't think anything was actually done about it. You know, I feel like it was, you know, something to alleviate any backlash against her personally and her PR. But I think it would be ideal if some like organized effort with these people, with these creators who have this privilege, to then lean back and pull these Black creators up, use their privilege, use their platform to do so.
So just let me back up a little bit, because I want to get also just a little bit of the sort of big history of TikTok here. So the dances, has this been in part a quarantine thing? Like, has this been about us being home and having really nowhere else to go and dance except our own living rooms?
You know what? I think that had a huge impact on it. The lockdown definitely did. Even following this journey with Black TikTokers, I have definitely lauded them over and over for their creativity. I mean, not with just the dances, but with these editing skills. You probably saw a few videos that went viral with how these creators edit their videos, and they're so creative, and it's so big that big corporations are seeing these things, such as Disney, you know, are seeing these things and seeing their talent. I'm like, there's so much, you know, undiscovered talent here, and they're able to do this on this platform. And that's what's the beauty of this platform, is like this universal way of getting out there. But again, I think there are some other underlying factors that makes, you know, this pretty much the standard of white supremacy keep going, even with something that seems universal.
All right, I'm going to make my 19-year-old sit down and actually get me on TikTok. Who should I be?
I love it.
Who should I be following? Is that a thing? Is that what you do? Do you follow people? How does that work?
Yes, you should definitely follow like the Kiara Wilsons. It's a lot of comedians that are out there with Black TikTok. There's the Eric Lewis is a great one that I mentioned before. There's so many great ones. It's so, even Black TikTok, if you follow that hashtag, you will find a whole bunch of, you know, things that would definitely tickle your fancy. And I would love, Melissa, to see you create one of the dances that they do in the future.
No, no, no. no, not, no. Mm-mm. I mean, I feel like I could hear my husband right now hearing this segment and being like, uh-uh, that woman is not your friend. Do not let her talk you into that. Tanja, yes. Renee Stidham is an entertainment writer for The Root and has just laid down a gauntlet of a challenge. I don't know. I just, my soul might have to do this. Thanks so much, Tanja.
Thank you so much, Melissa. It was great talking to you.
And this is what happened at my house last night when I asked my daughter, Parker, who's home from college this summer, to help me prepare for this segment.
We're doing a segment on the show about TikTok, and I need an account. So can you help me set it up?
Uh-huh. Let's do this. If you sing to it, it might download faster.
TikTok.
So now it asks for things you're interested in. Be careful, because then you'll get a bunch of kids my age, like, shaking their butt. So
I don't want that.
Yeah.
Okay, so, but wait. You missed class on TikTok? You weren't making TikTok. You were just scrolling through it?
Oops. Start watching. Okay.
Okay, wait. So it literally went immediately to a white girl dancing. Wow.
But you see how they're dancing to a Beyonce song?
Yes.
So swipe.
It literally went immediately to white girls doing black people stuff.
So swipe.
Oh, he is making some kind of peach cobbler. Yes. Oh.
Okay, so do you want to like this?
Oh, I want to like
this. So then like it.
That's yes, Pie Cross. What's the deal, though? I want to choreograph a TikTok dance challenge.
Uh-oh, I ain't signed up for that.
Okay, folks, that's the show. We really appreciate you tuning in. And if you want to tweet us your best TikTok dance, by all means, we're at The Takeaway. Trust me, we want to see those dances. Now, if you've missed anything or you want to listen back again, check out our podcast. You can download it wherever you get your audio or head on over to thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.